First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Will Florida parents get a win in court against the governor? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the high-stakes hearing this week over Florida's mask wars. Join us now, 549-2937. Then later, how you can help Afghan refugees coming to town to start a new life in Jacksonville. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. The state reported 26,203 new COVID infections and 9 deaths Tuesday. That is not data coming directly from the state. It comes from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Meanwhile, 50 Florida hospitals now have critical staffing shortages, and ICU beds are nearly 95% full. Against these numbers, against this backdrop, a hearing in a high-profile lawsuit is ready for closing arguments today. Florida parents are challenging Governor Ron DeSantis' executive order aimed at preventing local school boards from imposing student mask mandates. 10 school districts around the state, including Duval County, have already decided to defy the governor and require masks. So what's at stake in this hearing? What might we expect? Florida Attorney Charles Gallagher is representing some of these parents in court, and he's on the line now. Charles, good morning. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
And as we talk about Florida's mask wars, give us a call, 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. You know, I can't help but note the irony that this hearing is being conducted virtually, Charles. Because it's not safe to do it in court. At least the judge doesn't feel it is. But he is expecting a ruling. You are expecting a ruling in this Friday. You're representing parents who are challenging the governor's order under his Parents' Bill of Rights, forbidding schools from putting in mask mandates for students. 10 districts have already done so. So tell us what's going on in court and what we might expect.
Certainly. So today at 10:15, we will finish up the case with both sides giving their closing arguments. The court had then understandably asked for some time to go over all the evidence, the exhibits, and look at the law in preparation for his ruling. So we will all return back at 10 a.m. on Friday to have him rule on the merits of the case. So this is a adjudication of the merits fully, not any kind of nothing less. So Friday we'll know.
Parents testified this week that their children are too young to be vaccinated against COVID-19, and masks are the only way to protect them, and universal mask wearing is the only way to stop the spread of the virus. We need to note that here in our own school district, two schools already, Baldwin Middle High School and Duncan Fletcher Middle School, have closed and shifted to online instruction for the next week because there's such a high rate of transmission of COVID-19. Do you expect some of those numbers to possibly influence the judge's thinking on this?
Well, I think the judge is going to look at what was before him as far as evidence, but it is ironic that our medical experts did opine that this was an expectation, that you would have massive closing down of schools and classrooms, and there would be, you know, rampant infections rising. So this was not unexpected to those who were in the know and did go ahead and work in this area. You know, yesterday we had really kind of sad, poignant testimony from Dr. Quigley that he's telling people to not come to his ER because they'll be there for a six-hour wait. They don't have the ability to treat them, and they're so overburdened. Their nurses are wanting to quit. Everyone is working at full capacity with no possibility of relief. So not surprised to hear this, and I think the judge is going to look at what was before him in terms of record evidence and testimony from witnesses and expert witnesses, but I think it's borne out within that testimony.
What's your response to the state's position, the governor's position, that parents should be the ones to decide whether their child wears a mask to school?
That really is white noise. this is a public health issue in times where we have this, again, unprecedented spread of a pandemic that has nothing to do with what's going on right now. No one is asking parents to have rights limited as to the treatment of their children and health care. No one's asking for these parents to be forced to have certain procedures for their children. This is not a parent choice medical issue. This is all about a public health issue. And to tether back to what Dr. Quigley said yesterday, you know, we all have an obligation as a society to make this better. And part of that means allowing those in places of judgment, the school board directors and chairs and superintendents, to make elections for their school boards and for their schools on what is best. And if they deem, based upon the science and medicine, that a mask should be mandated in their schools, so be it.
Now, what's remarkable is that 10 Florida school districts have decided to defy the governor anyway. They're bucking the governor's order. They're mandating masks, including Duval County here in Jacksonville. The governor has threatened to take away the salaries of education officials who do this. They've basically told the governor, go ahead, make my day. So if the judge rules in your favor, can you explain what that means for the other school districts around Florida?
Well, and those school districts that acted still, in theory, have liability for these sanctions and penalties. Those would be removed if that executive order is vacated and declared unconstitutional. The remaining half of school districts, or the remaining half of students in those districts, would be free to make their decisions on masking without fear of these financial repercussions and fines and the like. So it would allow everyone to make a fact-based, expert medicine-based decision without fear of having some kind of financial repercussions.
More than half of Florida students now are already under mask requirements because the districts have defied the governor. Most of the large urban school districts, along with a few smaller ones. Can you talk too about how the Delta variant is impacting the urgency among parents? The state is arguing that last school year they didn't see much difference between schools that required masks and those that didn't have mask mandates. You're arguing that the new surge of cases caused by the Delta variant is increasing the urgency because more children now are getting sick and are coming into ICUs. Tell us what you're arguing.
Absolutely. And without getting too deep in the science, this R-naught factor is quite important on how quick the disease will replicate. And one of our experts gave a poignant example of previous to COVID Delta, during COVID Alpha, a person that had COVID would infect 1 to 2 people. Right now, a person with COVID Delta will infect 6 to 8 people. So that replication is far quicker and faster and larger in scope than COVID Alpha. And what our experts have said to a T is that Delta is different. All the data that was collected in last year's school year applies only to COVID Alpha. And so absolutely that was a different strain that had implications that, you know, quote, spared children. Now, many of children were sick and died because of COVID Alpha, tragically. But in terms of COVID Delta, this is a different variant that has some really scary and some really severe impacts upon the populations in schools. And that would be, it is affecting schools, school students, and it is replicating at a much, much faster rate. You know, last week we had 150,000 folks diagnosed with COVID. And we had 11 kids die under 16, and then we had 207 people die between that 16-year-old and 29-year-old window. We don't know how many of those broke out to be, so 16 to 18. But this is affecting children unlike COVID Alpha. So I think that the metrics and the math from last year just don't apply. And our experts did go ahead and confirm that soundly.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with attorney Charles Gallagher. He's representing a group of parents from across the state who filed a lawsuit challenging the governor's executive order banning mask mandates, I should say, in Florida schools. Leon County Circuit Judge John Cooper says he will probably rule on this tomorrow morning. If he issues a temporary injunction, all of the state's districts would have to theoretically get all students masked up. 549-2937. Give us a call. Ava in Jacksonville. Hi, Ava. Good morning. Go ahead, Ava. Go ahead and turn your radio down and go right ahead.
Our 14-year-old grandson lives with us, and he's a student at Lakeshore Middle, where they don't require masks, of course. And he's in bed running fever over 100 degrees for the last 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And he has COVID.
I'm so sorry.
He's a healthy kid, so
right.
Hopefully, you know, I mean, he's going to pull out of it, but I know there's a lot of children that aren't that healthy that may not make it.
Are you worried about catching it yourself?
No, ma'am. We've had both vaccinations, and we're doing just fine.
Well, that
and
Lakeshore Middle,
70s.
My goodness. Well, Lakeshore Middle, that's a Duval County public school, right? I mean, they will have to start masking after September 7th. But in the meantime,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
And I'm so sorry to hear that. I know it's got to be so frustrating, Ava. You know, how is your grandson talking about this? What's he telling you?
He's not much of a talker. But he's been really sick. He's a very active kid. He's very helpful to us. He's lived with us for most of his 14 years.
Uh-huh.
And he's just got a great attitude with us. But to see him down and sick is just disheartening, to say the least.
Well, you know, I'm going to say a little prayer that he gets better soon. The good news is that he does have, as a young man, a young teen, a strong immune system, and let's hope he'll be just fine. But, you know, Ava, I really appreciate you calling, because we've heard from so many parents and grandparents just like you who are dealing with this kind of situation. So thank you so much for the call, Ava. Charles Gallagher, these are the kinds of stories that we're hearing from families right now, and their worry about their children.
It's scary to hear that an otherwise healthy 14-year-old is so affected by COVID, and this belies all of the narrative by the expert for the governor that healthy kids don't get COVID. There has to be some other condition or illness that would let them get COVID. At the end of the day, kids that have no problems are getting COVID. They're getting COVID, and they're in the hospital, and they're dying. And that's what's most scary, is that it can affect anyone. And they can't get, if you're under 12, you can't get a vaccination. So you have a specialized class there of those students who are more vulnerable than any other students that are over 12 and can't get vaccinated.
549-2937. Of course, we heard from that grandmother, her son, or her grandson, I should say, is old enough to be vaccinated. A lot of parents and grandparents have held back on vaccinating their teenagers for a number of reasons, but anyone 12 and older is now eligible to be vaccinated, and that age could get as young as 5 pretty soon. What about the argument from the state? Talk about that a little more. The attorneys and the medical experts for the state are arguing that kids overall are just less likely to be affected. As you've noted, though, we are seeing sharp spikes in pediatric COVID cases, including children now in local and statewide ICUs.
So I would say that the allegation and argument that kids aren't affected may have had some credence during Alpha COVID times, during last year's school year, though there were still stats that bore out COVID infections among students. But this year, with the school year, with COVID Delta, that is not the case. I would point out that the state has one expert, an expert who has not treated students or children or adults ever in his entire practice as a doctor. He's candidly a medical economist at Stanford, and he has a whole lot of writing and a whole lot of reading, but in terms of treating patients, he has zero experience, and he concedes that. And he also was very, very ideological about his idea of herd immunity, which was directly assailed by Fauci at NIH, and anybody with legitimate medical credentials has disagreed with his conclusion. So I think that the argument that they present, and again, from the backdrop of the parents, experts, we presented four PhDs and four MDs and one PhD who work in this area day in, day out. The doctors treat patients, the doctors treat children, and what they're seeing does not comport with the narrative of the state's expert, who is admittedly a researcher. That's all he does.
Susan tweets the show, even if the state's lawyers are right that masks aren't effective against COVID-19, why aren't they doing other things like improving ventilation, mandating vaccines, etc.? Let me ask you about this, Charles. Testimony was presented in court this week on the other side of this, arguing that masks aren't effective in mitigating the spread of COVID-19. Is that right?
That's correct. It truly is an outlier in terms of testimony. I think you're not going to find support for that among any other medical society, association, APA, American Medical Association, CDC. All of these groups soundly believe that masking does work. And in terms of the literature, we queried their expert on current data and literature that was recently proposed by the CDC, and he didn't have knowledge of many of these studies and articles, and couldn't speak to what they concluded. The idea was that because kids didn't get sick during Alpha, and because kids would have this array of, again, unproven and really dubious medical effects of masks, and I'll point out that the expert knew of no child who died from wearing a mask. He knew of no child who was hospitalized from wearing a mask. But the same, again, narrative of argument that children can be harmed by masks, that masks don't, the risk of wearing masks does not outweigh the danger of masks, which is completely dubious science.
What are the risks to wearing a mask? Now, I've heard one argument that has gotten some traction is that particularly with young children, it can affect social and behavioral and even language development if all of the children are masked. What about that argument?
We presented evidence that if a parent would interact with their children after the school day is over, whatever nominal, and it's been described as very nominal effect of having that mouth covered in terms of seeing it during the school day can be mitigated. So the parents are going to go ahead and speak to their kids without masks in the home every day anyways. After school, they're going to engage with their students, their children, any way, any day. So this is really not a legitimate concern in terms of developmental issues. Now, additionally, our doctors have posited studies that this is a quick bounce back after the pandemic is over. People that did have any nominal effect, again, mitigated by daily communication with the parents themselves, will be back on track as the pandemic ends. So this is not any kind of a permanent problem. This is not really an appreciable problem either.
549-2937. Lots of tweets. Agata tweets the show, Fletcher had a very high opt-out rate on masks. I heard 25%. I'm curious if we can track school closures and compare the opt-out rates. You know, so as we see these two schools in Duval County, Charles, both closing and going to online instruction for at least a week, it's because the COVID is running rampant through these schools and because so many kids weren't masking up. A mandate would theoretically enable every school to stay open and keep kids physically coming into the building each day, which is what the majority of parents say they want.
Absolutely, and I'll be very curious to see these metrics as they come out on schools that have high opt-out rates for masks, medical, religious, otherwise, or for no reason, and what occurs in those settings when you have these commingled populations of masked children and unmasked children. That'll be very curious, and I would suspect, based upon our experts, that would correlate to more school closures, more classroom closures, and more cases.
How do you expect this judge, based on his jurisprudence in general, to rule on this?
This judge has done his homework. He has read every pleading filed. He has paid attention to every witness. He is on the issues factually and legally. We certainly hope he's leaning our way. We don't know right now how his inclination is. But in terms of objectively looking at the evidence, I don't know how objective you can be when you're in part of the case, but objectively looking at the evidence, we see putting on actual medical providers who treat kids every day in a children's hospital setting, in a private physician setting, in a community hospital setting, and a university-based public health expert who was, again, on the front lines. We see those experts as providing to the court guidance on the reasons why schools right now are unsafe, because of the populations that are in these schools with either commingled masking or non-masking or mask opt-outs, and just the prevalence of COVID right now in our state, the positivity rates that top out at 40% for the highest county last week. Many counties in the 30s, many more counties in the 20s, very few counties below the 20s. That positivity rate is scary. One out of four kids tested for COVID in the state of Florida comes up positive. And so when you look at that backdrop of science, and you hear from our parents who were clear and convincing that their children are not safe in the schools, they don't feel safe in the schools, and they don't feel that there have been adequate measures taken by the schools because they can be precluded and having their hands tied. So we think that those facts and that evidence is compelling for the court to side our way. Certainly have no tea leaves to know that.
Yeah, but sure.
We believe that it's...
We need to note that we did reach out to the attorney representing the state, your counterpart in court, Daniel Bean of Abel Bean Law, a Jacksonville attorney. He used to be on our WJCT board of directors, we should disclose. He declined our interview request, saying that the state needed to approve that. We were unable to get that approval or get anyone from the state to respond to us. So, Charles, if the judge rules in your favor, of course the state will appeal. Does that continue to leave districts in limbo while the matter works its way through the appellate process?
We've already prepared for that contingency, and we would also appear in the appellate court to oppose that. We would ask the trial court to vacate any stay that the appeal court would give under the facts of this case. So we're ready to go either direction, whether it's a ruling in our favor or their favor. And I think, candidly, whatever happens in this case does go to the first DCA on appeal. I don't think this is an issue that is resolved by the trial court's ruling once and for all.
So just so I'm clear, if you win, they appeal. What does it mean for a school district that isn't currently mandating masks in the interim?
Sure. So the effect of an appeal in Florida is that it would stay the trial court's order, stay the trial court's ruling. So during this appeal, there would be a freeze, so to speak, in the case while the appeal takes place. We would ask the trial court to vacate that stay, given the harm that would occur as a result of that delay in time. And this has been an emergency expedited case, really one of the fastest I've ever seen or heard of from start to finish. So I think there's a timeliness issue there on having that relief apply to the schools. So yes, an appeal would, divest the court of jurisdiction, the trial court of jurisdiction, but we would seek relief of the trial court to have that stay vacated and allow that order to be in place, the court's order, that is, that declares the EO unconstitutional.
We'll follow it. Charles Gallagher, always good to get your legal insights. Thanks for joining us.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. All the best.
And a quick note from the city of Jacksonville. Happening now is a salute to a healthcare hero vaccine clinic. This is going on now in honor of Dr. Leon Haley Jr., who recently passed away from UF Health Jacksonville. A vaccine clinic wellness on wheels bus happening now at 21 West Ashley Street, offering free vaccines from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Go get your vaccine in honor of Dr. Haley. Do it today. Much more still ahead later, how an over-the-counter device could soon improve your hearing, but up next.
Right now, for our organization, we've seen 22 come in the past 2 weeks. And to be honest, we really don't know how much more we will receive.
How you can help Afghan refugees coming here to Jacksonville. We'll be right back. Well, Afghan refugees fleeing the Taliban are resettling in Jacksonville, and you can help them get started with a new life here. For more, I spoke with Laura Cook. She heads up the refugee resettlement effort at Lutheran Social Services of Northeast Florida. Laura, it's good to talk to you. So tell us, how many refugees from Afghanistan have come to Jacksonville so far, and how many more can we expect?
Thank you for having me. Right now, for our organization, we've seen 22 come in the past 2 weeks. And to be honest, we really don't know how much more we will receive. We will definitely receive more. When they come to the U.S., they do receive a list of 18 cities, and Jacksonville is one of those cities.
Right. And, of course, Lutheran Social Services, along with Catholic Charities, you've been in the business of helping refugees resettle in the United States for a long time. Are these families coming from Afghanistan, are they people that were involved with the U.S. as interpreters and other allies that our government is trying to make sure get out and are safe?
Correct. So they have what's called a special immigrant visa because they have helped the U.S. in some way. They are either employed by the U.S. government in their home country, or they are interpreter and translator for the U.S. military.
Yeah. What's the process for these families to come to Jacksonville? And tell us about all of the moving parts, because it's a complicated process, isn't it, to get people into the country and then get them settled and get their feet under them?
Right. So generally, it's a pretty long process. And because we're a resettlement agency, our expertise is really once they get here. So we don't do anything with international processing. But from what we do know and from what we've heard is that they do need to have some kind of letter of support from their former U.S. military or Department of Defense supervisor. And then they go through the U.S. government to apply for this visa, and they go through interviews and background checks and screens. And it takes a long time. So some of these people that we've seen come, they applied actually years and years ago, and they've just been waiting to travel. They've gone through a lot of the steps or all of the steps to get this visa, and it's just been a very long, arduous process.
Wow. And, of course, we've all seen these incredible images of people desperate to get out of the country. So for those lucky enough to make it out, you know, you celebrate that, but you know the challenges for them are only just beginning. Can you talk a little bit about how hard it can be for a family who's been traumatized to come to a new country where they don't speak the language, they leave everything behind they've ever known because they literally were fleeing for their lives, and they have to start all over again?
Right. I always tell people, just imagine taking one or two bags of the belongings that you have, flying to a new country all of a sudden, and you're just getting plopped into this new country. It's a lot of challenges you have to face. First, language. Now, a lot of these, this is a special situation because usually the head of the household is a English speaker because they're an interpreter. Not all SIVs, not all of them speak English. But some of them do come with pretty good English proficiency, so that's something that's helpful for them. But their kids or their other spouse might not speak as good as English, but we have a lot of services to help them. You know, other challenges they might face, you know, cultural challenges. It's a big culture shock to come here in the United States. We have all very different values. We have just different way of life. Our health system's different. You know, everything is different. They have to learn all about everything about living in America really fast so they can become self-sufficient, you know, and that's where LSS steps in. Like, we are here for the first 90 days. They have a caseworker, and we do cultural orientation to kind of tell them about, you know, this is how what it means to live here. These are some of the values that we have. These are some expectations. You know, this is how a health system works. This is where you go for an emergency. This is or you access these resources. You know, we want to give them all the tools to be knowledgeable and to be able to have a successful life here. We also enroll them in different services to help them those first 90 days. They can be in English classes. We have English classes available all the way up to 5 years in the country. And then we do job orientation where we teach them expectations of employers, and we have a job placement program that can get them into jobs and even do career laddering, find them jobs that you know, are in the fields they're coming from or their skill based on their skill set. We'll enroll their kids in school. You know, school's hard because if you were on the run as a refugee, you might have lapsed a year in schooling, but you're getting put into the grade in school that your age corresponds. And you don't speak the language, but you're still required to take that level science class. So we also have services for them. We have after-school tutoring where we come alongside and help those refugee students be able to become successful in school.
So you have, and you do what they did in that country. You have interpreters to help people navigate this country. So
we have about 18 languages spoken at LSS.
Wow. Amazing. Yes. Now, 90 days, within three months, these families are expected to be at least somewhat self-sufficient.
Correct.
That is a high, steep hill to climb.
It is.
And then, you know, even going beyond the immediate needs that you help meet, these families are going to be suffering from trauma, PTSD. Mm-hmm. What about support for that?
Right. That's a really great question because they have gone through a history and a past that really not a lot of us could ever begin to comprehend. Thankfully, we do have a lot of great support systems here in Jacksonville. We have even organizations that specifically do mental health needs for refugees. So we do have a good support system here in the Jacksonville area, which we're very thankful for.
Can you let folks know what they can do right now to help your efforts settling these refugees and others that you work with?
Great. The one thing that we do have to do is we set up an apartment for them. We find an apartment based on their family size. And then we stock their apartment with goods, with house goods and furniture. And so if we don't have donations, then unfortunately, it will go onto their account and they'll have to pay for it. And we don't want to do that. So we collect donations, whether that be lightly used kitchen tables, kitchen chairs, lightly used couches. We also do collect a lot of house goods, pots, pans, plates, and sheets, and all that stuff is listed on our website, lsfjacks.org. And so when we have the donations, we can collect them all and set them up for, set up in their apartment. So they'll be set up for success once they arrive here in the United States.
Yeah. lsfjacks.org. You can make a monetary donation, or you can pay for specific items. I did it myself. Let me just disclose through your Amazon Smile link. I went on to that link at lssjacks.org. I picked out some items that you need right now for these refugee families. I paid for a few. They automatically get shipped to LSS, Lutheran Social Services, easy as pie. So I really recommend everybody do that. And keep us posted, Laura. It's such an important effort, and you guys are doing amazing work. Laura Cook, Lutheran Social Services, helping to resettle refugees from Afghanistan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the refugees fleeing Kabul bring to mind the 1975 evacuation in Vietnam. Just before the fall of Saigon in April 1975, Quang Pham, his mother, and his three sisters were evacuated via a U.S. military aircraft. It was arranged by their dad, a career South Vietnamese pilot helping American forces during the war. Quang's father stayed behind. He was captured by the Viet Cong, and he was held in prisoner of war camps for more than a decade as the rest of his family escaped to safety in the U.S. Now, Pham went on to study at UCLA. He joined the Marines as a helicopter pilot himself, and he served in the first Gulf War as well as in Somalia. These days, he's a biotech entrepreneur living in Ponte Vedra Beach, and he's written a book about his family's story. It's called A Sense of Duty, My Father, Our Journey from Vietnam. Quang Pham, a pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's good to be on.
Good to have you on. So, of course, you and everyone who was evacuated from Vietnam in the 70s has been watching what's happening with the evacuation out of the Kabul airport, and it's bringing back a lot of memories. Can I begin by asking you how this is affecting you as you're watching this unfold and your personal perspective?
Well, let me just say, I think the first feeling I got was how lucky my family was in 1975 to be able to get out in that first wave, which is what the world is watching now. The fall is just the beginning. There's going to be an ensuing decade of refugees as well as exchanges with those who have been left behind. Just like in Vietnam, it took over two decades. But it's tragic, and it's something that I didn't expect from our president, because as a former U.S. military service member, a Marine, I expect our leader to set the deadline and help our allies.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening to the Taliban tell us to get out by the 31st. So I think the number one difference with the Vietnam situation was we're setting our own deadline of August 31st. We're getting out on their terms. When Saigon fell, it was not a deadline set by the communists. It was a date that the communists started bombing the airport. And so the evacuation turned into the last 12 to 18 hours of the helicopters, which that's all we remember, you know, with these iconic images.
You were just a kid when you and your mom and siblings were evacuated. That I can't even imagine how traumatic that was for you.
Well, you know, I was almost 11. I just finished the fifth grade. And as you watch these refugees now coming in from Afghanistan, and we've seen some from Iraq and other countries, I look back and that we had lived through over 10 years of war already. And now we weren't the poor rice farmers and the folks who live in the countryside where most of the heavy fighting, you know, we lived in Saigon, but it's still, there were rocket attacks. We survived the Tet Offensive, the 1972 Easter Offensive. So we definitely lived through a decade of war. And so we didn't expect to leave the way we did. I think looking back, you know, 46 years later, I think the Americans knew, the South Vietnamese knew, and the North Vietnamese do, that that day Saigon was going to fall was coming. But for the civilians and the kids, it was an abrupt change to our lives during those last days of April 1975.
And your father left behind and imprisoned too.
Yes, when I look back, you know, there were a couple of decisions that changed my life and my sister's life. You know, the first decision was that my father, who had come to the United States, to Florida. And I'll tie in the Florida and the rich history of refugees in Florida. But my father actually came to Florida to train to fly twice in the late 50s and in the mid-60s. The decision that changed our life was that he was a senior pilot in the South Vietnamese Air Force, which is like the Afghan allies now that we've trained to fight and protect their country. In both cases, things didn't work out, but he made the decision to get my mother and my three sisters out on the first night of the evacuation. So we were very fortunate that we left in the middle of the night, because the evacuation was designed back then not to create panic for the rest of South Vietnamese to leave the country. The second decision that played a key part was that my mother, when we were in a refugee camp in Arkansas, made a decision to stay in the United States when we could have gone to Paris, where half of our family, as you may know and your listeners, France and Vietnam had a great relations, tough relations, but we all had, the kids in Saigon had French as a second language, so it was a natural fit, but she made the decision to stay and to receive sponsorship
And we left the camps in June 1975 and resettled in Southern California.
You know, and right before we brought you on the air, we spoke with Lutheran Social Services welcoming Afghan refugees coming to Jacksonville. This airlift out of Kabul could be the largest airlift in U.S. history. Already more than 80,000 people have been gotten out. They're taking out thousands a day. And you are living proof of the contribution refugees make to this country. You studied at UCLA. You served in the first Gulf War. Now you are an entrepreneur. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's a great country. I love this country, and going back, I wanted to finish my comment. Florida has a rich history. Eglin Air Force Base housed Vietnamese refugees in 1975. It was one of the four bases, Eglin being one of them, Camp Pendleton in California, Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, where we were, and Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania. So you're going to see the Afghans get processed at American bases overseas that they most likely come to U.S. bases where we have extra capacity to build tent cities and old hangars. And then from there, like in 75, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Services, the American Red Cross, the International Rescue Committee. But most importantly, what you're seeing is Afghan vets, American veterans of the Afghanistan and Iraqi conflicts, like the American Vietnam vets, they came to the camps and helped us. The locals, the volunteers, you know, the opposition in Congress and in the media was great in 75 because of the high unemployment rate. They did not want the refugees to be settled, so the design was to spread us all out across the country. But in at the end, the American way of welcoming new immigrants, going back hundreds of years, proved out to be greater than the hatred and all the comments that you're seeing on the websites about taking care of Americans first. We have to remember that we went into Vietnam, we went into Iraq, and we went into Afghanistan for American foreign policy, but our allies depended on that help, and when we decide to pull out, there are consequences. And if you look at what President Ford did as he was the biggest proponent, the biggest voice for us. He came to our refugee camp in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. He fought the congressional opposition. And by December of 1975, all 130,000 refugees had been settled. And another key point was that there were American sponsors across the country that took in families like ours. Many of them were Vietnam veterans, and many of them were just good Americans that have great hearts, and
absolutely.
Grateful, and that was one of the major decisions I made when I became an American citizen, was to pay back for that generosity.
Let me disclose, my dad's a Vietnam veteran too, and he was a pilot, an Air Force pilot, when I was a little kid. So, you know, this is personal for me, and I'm so honored to be able to tell your story. Thank you, Quang. Quang Pham, he is a Ponte Vedra entrepreneur and a Gulf War vet. Buy his book. It's called A Sense of Duty, My Father and Our Journey from Vietnam. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, and in a moment.
The drive behind it is a really good push. We need to make hearing health care affordable and accessible for everybody, regardless of circumstance. I really do think that that's the driving force behind this push in the OTC market.
Actually getting something over the counter so you can hear a little better. We'll hear from the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center next.
Asteroid approached Earth a few years ago, scientists suddenly grappled with an age-old question. Could this be a sign of alien life? Matthew Bothwell is an astronomer at the University of Cambridge, and he joins us to talk about the rock named Oumuamua, the theories that sprung up around it, and how scarce data can sometimes lead to wild speculation. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Clarissa Ward talks about interviewing Taliban fighters in Kabul, Afghanistan, as they celebrated their victory. She also reported on the chaos at the airport. She left on a military flight with hundreds of refugees. Ward is CNN's chief international correspondent. This was not her first time interviewing Taliban fighters. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Celeste Headley. If a community is not safe for black travelers, especially after dark, it's often called a sundown town. Now some of these towns are integrating, so does that mean they're now not dangerous for black travelers? We'll dig into racial travel advisories. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Dating is always complicated, but dating in a pandemic is a mess. And dating in a pandemic with vaccines, but also breakthroughs, is throwing thousands of singles for a loop. From vaccine checks to mask mandates, just going out to dinner has become a test of values and even personal safety. We talk love in the time of coronavirus next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, do you have hearing loss, but you feel like the cost might be holding you back from getting a hearing aid? You're not alone. The price is a barrier for many. That's why Congress passed a law in 2017 to authorize over-the-counter hearing aids for adults with mild to moderate hearing loss. To speed things up, this year, President Biden issued an executive order including directions on how to move forward with this. The goal is low-cost hearing devices you can buy in a drugstore. You know, kind of like the reading glasses you can buy at a Walgreens. Unfortunately, we are still waiting to see when OTC hearing aids will be widely available over the counter. But I got a little more about this and some other news related to the world of hearing from Dr. Sarah Myers with the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center.
Hey, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. Good to talk to you.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what's new in your world at the Speech and Hearing Center.
Well, so with audiology, I think a lot of people have seen the news about the new OTC, so over-the-counter hearing aid push. It's been a hot topic. It's really been a hot topic for years, but it's gotten a lot more attention now with President Biden's the executive action. And so it's good for people to understand, just be educated on it. Mm-hmm. So to begin with, I think the OTC, the drive behind it is a really good push. We need to make hearing healthcare affordable and accessible for everybody, regardless of circumstance. And so I really do think that that's the driving force behind this push in the OTC market. And so we at the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center, we definitely approach this new phase of audiology open-mindedly, but cautiously as well. In just that, we want people to understand when they should be seeing an audiologist and a professional, because when we strictly go the out of or the over-the-counter route, we are cutting out, you know, seeing a doctor. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I say it's like, you know, we're not going to call a doc, you know, our primary care and say, hey, I'm sick, and then just prescribe you medication. Well, what are we sick with? What's the appropriate medication? And then is it working? So it's really important for people just to understand, you know, there are concerns that we want to have addressed. A lot of times there are other underlying medical conditions that can be causing hearing loss. So if someone feels like they're hearing better just on one side, or if they feel like wax is causing it, or it could be ear infections or fluids, that's something that we want a professional to check out. So it's just educating people and understanding that the over-the-counter way will be appropriate for some, but may not be appropriate for all, just like, you know, reader glasses at our grocery stores or our pharmacies.
Okay. In this pandemic, people are experiencing ringing in the ears, vertigo. Sometimes it it turns out to be COVID-19. What are your thoughts about these kinds of symptoms that are cropping up right now and how that relates to hearing loss?
So we are seeing a lot more sudden hearing losses and ringing, and a lot of times people will notice this after COVID. It's something that's new. We don't quite, you know the science behind it yet, but there is definitely a relationship between COVID and ringing and hearing loss. And that ringing in our ears, that is something that can happen even if we haven't had COVID, right? So that's called tinnitus. Mm-hmm. And what tinnitus is it's a perception of sound either in your ears or in your head that doesn't have an external source. So a lot of people will say, they have ringing or they have crickets, ocean-like noises, or I even have had patients who it's music. And it's important to note that this is normal. Even people with normal hearing can have it. And there are a lot of factors that can cause it. So medication, certain different types of health issues, even caffeine, diet can cause ringing. And then most of the time where we see tinnitus is with hearing loss. And so it's really important to know that that ringing, it's not a sign that you're going deaf. It's not making you lose your hearing, but it's a symptom or a result of your hearing loss. Always a really good indicator if you are experiencing it, whether it's every day, all day, or if it just comes and goes, to just meet with an audiologist and assess your hearing so at least you have a baseline to go off of.
Again, that's the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center. And happy hearing. Thanks for listening to this, too. And thanks to senior producer Heather Schatz, associate producer Catherine Hobbs, and director Josh Torres. Our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield runs our digital operation. Speaking of which, drop us a line. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Catch our podcast up later today on all platforms, including the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then, everyone, and please mask up. Go downtown to Ashley Street 2 to get a free vaccine today, courtesy of the city. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.